My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands.
Listen every Thursday or join the conversation anytime on Instagram at What's Her Story Podcast.
Sarah LaFleur is the founder and CEO of MM LaFleur, known for women's power casual workwear.
When you first started your career, Sarah, you did not intend to be an entrepreneur. You went into finance and you were a management consultant. What was the moment that changed that?
The moment I changed that was really because I didn't know what else I was going to do with my career, which very much at that point felt like my life. I think the way many of us think about our careers in our 20s. But Sam, the way you just asked that question reminded me when I was working in management consulting, we had like a session on entrepreneurship. And there was a partner at the firm came and said like, well, you know, do you think any of you are entrepreneurs? And looked around the room, and I think one person out of 30, our class was 30 people, raised his hand. And then he was like, well, what do you think about the rest of you? And he was like, and someone else said, well, I don't know, maybe I'm an entrepreneur, maybe I'm not. And he said, well, if you're not sure about it, then you're definitely not an entrepreneur, because an entrepreneur, they know in their hearts that they're an entrepreneur. And I was like, well, I guess I'm not an entrepreneur then, you know, I was like, I definitely don't feel it. And if anything, my mother being an entrepreneur, I just saw how hard it was up close, you know, how much it spilled into our lives and her life, really, like how much it affected her personally, you know, how difficult the people management side was and how friends that she worked with, they had falling out. And I would often see her like, I always say, like, I would see her sipping whiskey by herself in the middle of the night when I would come down for a glass of water. So, like, I think having seen it up close, I was like, this is not for me. And it was really only when I left my last job, having only been there for 4 months. And so I, like, really kind of, like, rushed out of there without a plan B and, you know, didn't know what I was going to do next with my life, that I was like, well, I've always had this idea. Maybe I should work on it.
That had to be a tough period of time. What was it like for you?
I think I had been wandering as I think, you know, I certainly felt that way in my late 20s. I'd left consulting. I applied to business school, didn't get in. I ended up taking this job at a private equity firm that I really respected and basically 1 week in knew that, like, this was not a place where I was going to be successful. The culture was so different from what I was used to and what I knew I was going to, you know, be happy in. And so I felt like I gave it a good try, but I was so, like, miserable doesn't even begin to describe it. Like, I was getting, you know, I had nervous tics. I would be, like, shaking in my seat. I would get, you know, kind of anxiety attacks thinking about having to go to work the next day. And I really ran out of there. So, you know, I would say it was like one of the lowest moments of my professional confidence. I mean, lowest moments of confidence, period. And that was the way, that was really how MM started, you know, not knowing what to do next with my life.
It's really hard to start a business. A lot of people think about it. But, like, what were the first things that you actually tangibly did?
I kind of started with the formalities, which in retrospect was somewhat silly, but I think it was important for me to feel like I was committing to it. So I incorporated in Delaware, and that somehow made it seem real. It was LaFleur LLC, and that was a surprisingly easy process. And I was like, okay, I'm really doing this. And then I rented a tiny office space, which I gave up 2 months later because I realized I couldn't afford it. But it was when WeWork only had two buildings at that point. And I rented a small $500 per month space. And that actually got me out of the house every day. So that was a good thing. And that was actually the first kind of weirdly logistical thing that I did. And then I just started talking to anybody who I thought knew anything remotely about fashion design. And I really did not know anybody in this world of fashion design. And, you know, just to kind of give you a sense of how much I didn't know, you know, the only way I could see myself getting connected to someone who worked in fashion design was through someone who I'd gone to school with who had gone on to interior design school at RISD. And I was like, well, that's a little bit closer to fashion design. Maybe she'll know someone. And then she happened to know one person who went to the fashion department and connected me with her. And so she was like the first designer that I had actually spoken with. And she ultimately was the one who introduced me to a headhunter. I knew that I wanted a co-founder from the get-go. I wanted someone with actual design expertise who had worked in the high-end fashion world. That was really, really important to me because I wanted the clothing that we made at MM to really reflect the kind of clothes that you would get at a high-end fashion brand. And so a lot of people said, why don't you just design it? Why don't you just, you know, add a sleeve to a theory dress, or, you know, take a Giorgio Armani suit, but make it for cheaper. And I was like, no, you're kind of missing the point. Like, there's a whole gap here in terms of what I'm looking for. I'm looking for clothing that is not only beautiful, of course it has to be beautiful, but it has to be machine washable and wrinkle resistant, and it has to be super comfortable. And I never want to have to be, you know, pulling at the seams to make sure things are fitting well. I'm really trying to create something different. And so ultimately it was through this headhunter that I met my co-founder, Miyako. And she's actually also Japanese. I'm half Japanese. And people think that, you know, we met through the Japan connection, but we actually met in the meatpacking district. Like, you know, we met through a headhunter. So that was probably like the next tangible step that I took.
How did you convince her to take a leap with someone who'd never been in fashion before? She'd had this illustrious career, been designing for Zac Posen. She was entrenched in the fashion world. Was it a pitch you had to give her, or was she sold right away?
I think she was curious right away. And I think in retrospect, I really see, you know, it's all about kind of where you are in your life. And I think if I had pitched it to her any other time, she very likely would have said no. This was when I initially started talking to her. This is 2011. So we were kind of coming out of the recession. But she saw a lot of her colleagues in the fashion world get laid off. And she also saw a lot of, you know, these fashion brands that she respected go under. And I think she was really, she was going through her own existential crisis, saying like, why should I be in fashion? Like, when everything out there has already been designed, what is there to make? And I think she also sensed the enormous waste that exists in the high-end fashion world. You spend months and months putting together these fashion shows that are, you know, over and done in 5 minutes. And most of those clothes that end up on the runway are never to be seen again. And so when I came to her and said, like, look, there's this entire group of working women who think that everything out there right now doesn't meet their needs, and they want to be comfortable, and it's not like they want to be frumpy. You know, there's this, like, I think that when people think of American working women, you know, immediately it's like working girl, like sneakers and big shoulder jackets, and like the last thing you think is fashionable, right? Like that American women, working women, like, are typically not associated with style. And I was like, I think there's a real opportunity to change this. And are you interested? And she was like, yeah, okay, I'm curious. And she always says to me, or she said to me since then, she was like, apparently I said something along the lines of like, you know, I really don't know anything in fashion, but I'm not stupid. So I'm confident that I will figure it out as I go along. And she was like, okay, like, why not? Like, why not take a chance on you? And so that is how it started. But I think it had to do with, like, where she was in her life and being kind of really curious about what was there a different way to operate a fashion business.
And then how did you fund the business?
Very haphazardly is how I would say it. So the first thing I had done, actually talking about one of the first things we did, I grew up in Japan, so I had a bank account in Japan that I had been putting some money away in. And I called up my mother and I said, I want you to, you know, help me transfer it all into this business account. And she was like, all? And I was like, yes, all. Which I would not have the guts to do today. But I was 27 and, you know, I didn't have kids, no mortgage, like no responsibilities. I just had to worry about me. So I was like, let's just go all in. And I had $36,000 saved up at that point. So I went all in, put that into LaFleur LLC. And then I asked my parents if they'd be willing to lend me the same amount. So they very kindly said yes. So we started with $72,000 in the bank account. And actually that got me through the first year of hiring Miyako, because her rate was $10,000 to design a line of 7 dresses. I paid $2,000 to my headhunter because he always took a 20% cut. And I always say it's the best $2,000 I ever spent on this business. And then, you know, I think we spent like $10,000 to buy the fabric. You know, we were going to launch with a line of 7 dresses. And one of the best pieces of advice that I got, and I still say this to entrepreneurs who are looking to manufacture things today, is don't hold inventory if you can. You know, just have a sample and get orders against your sample and then go and place the order, because you never know what's going to sell or how much of it is going to sell, especially in the early days, and you never want to be stuck with that inventory. So what we did was we bought the fabric, and we brought 7 dresses, and we started doing these trunk shows, and we took orders based on that, and then we would place the order at one of the factories in the garment district, who we had to beg to work with us. You know, it was just really interesting. I thought, like, if you were willing to pay, anyone would take you on, but you know, no factory wants to take you on because they see designers come and go all the time, and they need consistent revenue. So I said, I'll pay extra. So please take my orders. And this Korean gentleman agreed to manufacture these dresses for us. And then we would turn it around usually in 2 to 3 weeks because we had the fabric. And then we would rent a zip car, remember those, and then drive around the city. And it would be me and my co-founder, my other co-founder, Nuri, she would be sitting in the passenger seat and we would drive around and she would jump out and, you know, drop off the dresses and then jump back in the car again. And then we would, you know, finish our day of delivery. So like that was really the early days of how we got started. But $70,000 actually got me through that kind of initial phase. And it was only after that we began. That's not even true. The first 5 years, I think I was kind of collecting small checks as we went along. I raised maybe $4 million in the first 5 years. And it wasn't until 2016, so yeah, 5 years into the business, that we actually closed our Series A. And it took a really long time.
Just to put a pin in that, because I think, you know, a lot of people who don't have experience with entrepreneurship, they read the news and they're like, oh, this company started and they raised a seed round and then they raised a Series A and then they raised a Series B. And people think there are these like discrete periods of time between doing that. But for you, it sounds like it was different. I know for me, it's been different. For Sam, it's been different. But like you kind of just were always kind of raising as you're growing.
I know. People think I'm nuts. People will say to me, you're raising again. And I'm kind of like, I never really stopped.
Correct. And it was so funny because I think, you know, there were so many direct-to-consumer brands that were cropping up at that time. You know, Warby Parker, Bonobos, Everlane, and they would always announce these funding rounds, you know, like so-and-so closes X round, raises X million dollars. And I was like, what the hell am I doing wrong? Like, because I was like, I had a quote-unquote seed round basically going for 4 years. So it was incredibly messy. But I think like the piece of advice that I've got and I pass on is like, first of all cash is green, and there's something to be said about a lot of, and you say it's friends and family, but like, it, I mean, true, I think maybe I have like three true friends and family on the cap table. Everyone else is like the friend of a friend of a friend. And a lot of that capital is really, in some ways it's attractive because, you know, they're supporters of you. They're not necessarily saying, okay, like I'm expecting a 20x return within a certain time period. Like in some ways it's very flexible capital. So I got ample time to, I think, actually like make mistakes and also go slowly in a way that I think when we got to our Series A, like we were really late to raise our Series A, and we were told that as much, you know, that our revenue was kind of beyond what people would typically consider a Series A round. But, you know, I think as a result, I got to maintain more control of the business. I think I had a better handle of what we were doing. So yeah, I think there isn't such a formula. And I think this is especially true of female founded businesses.
If you had to do it over again, would you have done the capital raising any differently?
It's a really great question. I have to start by saying, like, I don't know how I could have done it differently. Like I was a first time entrepreneur. Most investors didn't want to touch fashion with a 10-foot pole. I had a really difficult time convincing VCs that this was a business worth backing. And it really wasn't until like the revenue started to grow and the trajectory was obvious that people were saying, okay, you know, I'm willing to take a chance. So also, I would say I was young and I was happy to live on happy is maybe a strong word, but, you know, I was paying myself $48,000 a year. And then I was tutoring on the side. And I did that for 2 years to make ends meet. And I couldn't do that now. I've got three small kids and a mortgage. And I now, you know, I used to never go to the doctor in my 20s. And now I go like seemingly pretty regularly. So like, it's just interesting. Like I would say I probably couldn't start a business without proper funding.
And now a quick break.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big MQL man. Then he just kept saying things like, the more MQLs, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means marketing qualified lead. One thing's for sure. I'll be known as the MQL man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/customer to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/customer. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Another question about kind of the early days as you really grew through trunk shows. How did you find the people to host the trunk shows?
A lot of friends, a lot of girlfriends who helped me, and then a lot of coworkers. One of them, her name's Lucy DeLand. She was the COO at Paperless Post, and now she runs a VC. But she was a girlfriend from college, and I think, you know, she also ran a startup, so she just knew how important your friends were and your network is in helping initially get your business off the ground. So she said, you know, come host a trunk show in my house. And her husband, I think, was at business school at that time. So she invited a bunch of his business school friends who remain some of our best customers to this day, you know, almost 10 years later. We did one in Washington, D.C., also hosted by like three of my college friends. And yeah, it was very much like friends coming out of the woodworks to support me. My very first customer was actually one of my first bosses at Bain, the management consulting firm I worked at. And I also talked to a lot of women in their 20s who were saying, I don't love my job. I'm trying to find the thing I'm actually passionate about. And I say, I totally understand that, you know, I've been there, but like, you know, do the best job that you can in the job that you're currently in, because you know, that's going to lead to something else. And I've really found that to be true, you know, that friends and colleagues from previous places have really come to help me start the business.
I love that advice, because I think that work ethic is so pivotal. We always remember someone's work ethic. You don't necessarily remember whether they were the perfect fit for that job or how their career trajectory looked, but you do remember their work ethic. It's great advice for young people. You can shine anywhere.
Yeah, for sure. And even if you know, you kind of know, like, oh, this is not really my thing. I'm not really, like, this is not me at my best. But I've found that, like, just the connections that you make, and hopefully you meet people you genuinely like and admire, regardless of what your job you're in, and those relationships have been so important to me, just like personally, but also professionally and growing a mom.
How have your sales evolved? Is that something that still keeps you up at night today, or does it take care of itself at this point?
Right now, we are probably 95% online. And we've gone through so many phases. You know, I would say brick and mortar or just meeting our customers in person was always a really, really important part of our business. And so even though we said we were direct to consumer, we didn't necessarily mean that we were e-commerce only. Like our stores and our, we call them showrooms. We have one in New York City in Bryant Park and one in Washington, D.C. But we had had, I think, nine, you know, prior to COVID. And unfortunately, we had to close them all during the pandemic. And then we opened Washington, D.C. up in the fall of 2020, which ended up being kind of a catastrophe because we're located two blocks from the White House. And we couldn't even access our store for like 6 weeks around the insurrection. I mean, it was madness. It's been a really, really tough couple of years for brick and mortar retail. But we did open up our Bryant Park showroom in fall of 21. And then we're looking to open up three more this year. So we're really leaning back into in-person retail stores. E-commerce is kind of the thing that kept us going, you know, even through the pandemic. And we had this really, really hard moment in the early days of the pandemic when, you know, we really didn't understand what COVID was. And there was this big decision point. We had just closed all of our stores. We had furloughed all of our retail employees. And we had to make a decision about whether to keep the warehouse open. And I knew that if we closed the warehouse, our sales would go to zero. You know, we literally wouldn't be able to ship anything out. We would have to furlough the entire company. Or we could keep the warehouse going and at least bring any e-com sales. And we decided to go with the latter and try to take as many precautions as we possibly could to keep our warehouse team safe. You know, that those were kind of like the real challenges that we were going through in the early days of the pandemic. And so, Sam, to your question about like sales, do they take care of themselves? They never take care of themselves. I would love to be in a place where I was like, you know what, there's just like recurring revenue on a daily basis. But like I and the rest of my team, you know, we're watching the numbers like a hawk. And it's fascinating also how much what's going on in the world affects your numbers. You know, Roe v. Wade, that decision came out. And frankly, the weekend that followed, terrible for sales. And, you know, whenever there's bad news and the recession is certainly looming. And so that's kind of a real risk that we're facing. But I also think like that's actually one of the fun, maybe too strong a word, but I think, I guess I would call it fun. There's an element of like, okay, you always have to react to what's going on. And like retail, you can actually be quite nimble. You know, you can come up with new tactics, new marketing pushes, new price changes, new promotions. Like there are actually so many levers at your disposal. And I think one of the reasons I never get tired never get bored of running a retail business is because it keeps you on your toes constantly.
How did the pandemic changes in fashion impact you now that everything's become more casual?
I mean, we saw it in our own dressing behavior in the very beginning. You know, we MM LaFleur was very much a company that was dressing women who went to the office, who were in places where they were being seen and had to look presentable. And I don't necessarily mean just like people who were lawyers and bankers. I mean, I think anyone really, like anyone who had a professional job who had to dress a certain way. And I mean, I even remember this about myself in the early pandemic days. Like I just stopped wearing makeup. I was like, who the F cares? Like, I'm just like, and you know, it was the very early days. And we saw, you know, consumer demand obviously drop. And there was this moment where we were like, what is the point of MM in this new world? Like, is our business even relevant? And I think for the first 2 to 3 months, I was really unsure. And I think actually as the pandemic went on, we started to hear from customers. There were a few things that we did kind of just at the get-go. We had these like perfect travel pants. We called them the Colby Origami suiting pants. But actually, I kept on wearing them in the early days of the pandemic because they had this elastic waistband and it was like made from this like super comfortable fabric. And so I was like, you know, what if we named these the Colby joggers instead of the origami suiting pants? And sales grew by 8x just based on that name change, you know, and just positioning things differently. Yeah, so that was really wild. And we just started making small tweaks like that because I think we were always proud of the fact that our clothes were meant to be comfortable. Like, even if they were meant, you know, to be clothes that you were going to be seen in, they were always meant to be comfortable. So I think a lot of it was like, could we just reframe them in a different way? And customers reacted really, really well to that. And I think as time went on, we said like, okay, what is actually the new way that women are going to be dressing? Because, you know, I think to my earlier point of like, you know, what is the point of MM? A lot of the angst that I think women and people in general feel about getting dressed, it's not as though that disappeared with COVID. You know, in fact, I think what we're hearing a lot now is like, I've now gone hybrid and I don't know what dressing for a hybrid work environment looks like. Or I have a lifestyle now where I'm in the office, I'm working from home in the morning, but then I go into the office in the afternoon. And everyone's saying that we can dress a little more casually, but I don't actually know what that means. And so we're getting a lot of questions. And I think MM was always created to solve this like problem. And I would say like a lot of it is angst. You know, we talk about women on average spending 2 more weeks per year versus men getting ready in the morning, which is crazy, right? It's like, what would you do with that 2 weeks? But it's not as though like suddenly that 2 weeks was given back to all women because of COVID. Like, I think actually, if anything, women are just as stressed. You know, I'm speaking also for myself, but like a lot of women put on weight during the pandemic. And so I'm like, how do I dress? You know, do I buy new clothes or do I buy things that kind of like can flex with your size? And so, you know, as a business, the direction we've been leaning into, we're calling it power casual. And that's really a lot of customers who were dressing business casual were saying, actually, the new look is power casual. So, you know, if you've got business formal being kind of the most formal way of dressing and suiting, and then you've got business casual, a little more, you know, dressed down, and then you've got like casual all the way at the bottom, then power casual is this like new thing somewhere in between business casual and creative casual, where you want to show that like you're looking ready to get down to business. You're there and you're presentable, but it's flexible. It's clothes that you could also be going out to drinks with your friends in, or picking up your kids from school in. Like, it doesn't look like, oh, she was at the office and she just like walked over here. So that's the look that we are pushing forward and really talking to our customers about, and has really allowed our business to rebound and grow again. And, you know, what I'm focused on for 22 and beyond.
And now, a quick break.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed...
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562 562- 314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Was there ever a time where you thought the business might fail?
Multiple times.
Yeah.
How did you find inspiration or whatever you needed to push through those moments? They're scary.
It honestly just felt like one, it's like a cliche of one foot in front of the other. But like, I think if I knew, if someone had like tapped my shoulder in like March 2020 and then said like, hey, you know, I know everyone's saying like, this is going to be like a 2 week thing or maybe a 3 month thing, but actually like, you're not going to even get close to normal for another 2.5 years. Good luck. I think I would have just been like, well, that's it. Like, I don't have it in me. Like, I'm calling it quits. But like, this is about like, I think the human spirit being incredibly resilient. And when you're actually just like in it day to day, you're like, well, I just have to keep going. Like, there is no other option. And so we did. And I have to say, like, I have a team that I love. A lot of them have been with me for a really, really long time now. You know, we're talking 5+ years. I think the majority of our team has been with us for 5+ years. And so, yeah, I mean, I felt like I owed it to them to really see it through because they were willing to stick it through, you know. I mean, it was such a hot job market. It still is. They could have gotten a job in so many other places, but I felt like they kept showing up, and so I had to, too.
You talked about how clubby the garment center manufacturing world can be, but fashion is just as clubby. Has the fashion industry accepted you?
I think they honestly don't know what to do with us. And it was, we have been very lucky to receive a couple of awards by fashion groups, but whenever we went to the kind of award ceremony, they would be like, who are you? Like, we've never heard of you. No. Where do you sell through? And we're like, just direct. And they're like, what? You know, like, you're not like, what departments are you with? Or like, you know, where do you advertise? Like, I'm actually specifically remembering this one award that we got where we were sitting at a table with like a bunch of publishers. Cause that's, you know, it's basically the old school network is like publishers, department stores, and fashion brands. It's like, That's the world that you operate in. And if anything, actually, I remember when we were first launching, I got to meet with an editor who had been, I can't even remember, but she was at, you know, I can't, Harper's or Vogue or one of those very well-established fashion magazines. And she looked at my dress and she was like, but that's so boring. Like, what would I have to say about that dress? And I was really hurt by that comment. But I think in retrospect, I understand she was, you know, for with magazines, it's like they want things that are flashy and eye-catching and something being practical, you know, something is like, oh, it's a sheath dress that's machine washable and wrinkle resistant, has pockets. Just like, nah, it's like so not sexy, right? Like, so I felt like I got written off by the fashion world or I had, you know, I was like, well, they're not going to want anything to do with us. We're going to have to just like pave our own way. And I think to some extent that's been a fine strategy for us. I do have this dream though, and because now apparently it's all about us manifesting it, I'm just going to put it out there, which is I really do want, Miyako to win a CFDA one day. And she is someone who is so deserving of that. You know, she is such an amazing, talented designer and actually so also intelligent. She's not just artistic. You know, she's really thinking about, okay, what are her problems and how am I going to try to solve them? And so I'm just going to say this, you know, Anna Wintour, if you're listening, I want you to take a look at Miyako Nakamura.
Stay tuned for part two of our two-part series with Sarah LaFleur. Sometimes we have a guest that just warrants two episodes. We'll be talking about her infertility issues, her wildly unexpected childbirth outcome, her parenting journey, and we also give Sarah some parenting advice on how to manage the 3-kid, or in Amy's case, 4-kid juggle.
Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would appreciate it if you leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer, Stacey Pera, and our male perspective, Blue Burns.